Warning, Star Trek From the Holodeck contains adult language and discussions. If you're easily offended, do not continue to listen.
Lock it alone!
Fire.
Holodeck 3 program is reinstated.
Open sesame!
Commander Klingon vessel. We are energizing transporter beam. Now.
Hello, welcome everyone to Star Trek From the Holodeck, the Discovery Edition. I am Michael Flores, the host of the Holodeck. And over yonder is Ensign David Sabal. Hello, David.
Hello, everybody.
All right, so today we have a very good episode to discuss. Episode 4 of Season 3, Forget Me Not. Listen, Dave, I love this episode, and I'm not afraid to say so.
Same here. I'm with you on that.
I'm just going to splooge all over the place immediately. I'm not going to hold back. I'm not going to play coy. I'm just going to say. Just great.
Just fantastic.
Top-notch writing. This is what we've been waiting for a very long time, an episode like this. And when I say such hyperbolic things, it doesn't mean we didn't appreciate what came before. It doesn't mean we didn't like or enjoy previous seasons of Discovery. And I feel like I have to say that because I know we've been hit with some comments lately about us, you know, saying certain things about past seasons. I'm like, listen, I loved it. There's just some issues here and there.
Yeah.
But this season just seems to be firing on all cylinders.
Right from the get-go, too. I mean, the thing about Discovery is, especially when you take a look in parallel with the first two seasons, They start off with mysteries everywhere. The main seasons, season one and season two, the main beginnings always start off with a mystery.
Well, the mystery seems to be more important in previous seasons than the actual characters.
Exactly.
Many times.
Here this season, it's reversed.
Right.
The characters are the ones that are important, and it almost gives like a really cool refresh to the entire series.
Well, Dave, how many other Star Trek shows really start finding themselves during season 3 or season 4? That's kind of par for the course at this point, right?
It is. I mean, especially when you take a look.
I mean, look at Next Generation. Let's just say it. The first season wasn't that great.
It was rough.
Deep Space Nine was enjoyable for a couple of years, but it didn't get really good until season 3. Same thing with Voyager. Same thing with Enterprise.
Yeah.
It's kind of the thing. So I think we got to give them a chance to get the show going, have them figure out how these characters work, which ones the audience gravitate to, what stories do they want to tell, how do they want to steer this giant story of a or ship of a story around, and what are they going to do? What's going to be the focus? And this season just feels like they have a very specific goal in mind, and they're not going to deviate.
Yeah, because like when you think about it, season one and season two, they were kind of trying to reintroduce us to the universe of Star Trek.
Right.
And they were trying to show us their concepts, their own concepts of what the Star Trek universe was going to be like. At this point, they said, okay, we've done all that. We've shown you the universe as we have decided that it has to look like. Now we can focus more on the characters right in front of us. We can focus on Burnham. We can focus on Saru. We can give those characters now the platform that they need to kind of become mainstays like a Kirk Spock.
It takes time.
It takes time.
And honestly, Dave, the way the episode opened up with the doctor's log.
Dude, that was cool.
That was exceptional. It was a great way to continue to flesh out our core crew members and continue to bring them more into the forefront of the series. Captain Saru bringing the crew together by getting them to talk and reminding them that we are all in this together. As he said. And this led to some additional character development, which we'll get into during the second half of our discussion. The cinematography of this series has always wowed me. And this season is no different. It's classy. It's the New York Philharmonic of Star Trek. That's what Discovery is. It oozes just
class.
Yeah.
It just,
I don't know how else to say it. The opening shot of the episode with Discovery drifting on the left side of the frame and a sea of stars alone was a great way to use visual imagery to convey a tone, which also works with the theme of the episode, loneliness. Fear of being alone, adrift. Will anyone remember you if you just simply disappear?
Yeah, and I especially like in the beginning of those shots, you have the doctor talking, and he doesn't, they use the dialogue not to blatantly say what the problem is, but almost kind of like
introduce the potential. Yeah.
Like showing like the shot of him walking down the corridor and showing everybody, like everybody that passes him. And the doctor's dialogue makes it sound like, oh, we're all stuck here on this ship and there's a lot of them. There's a lot of crew around him. But the way it's shot gives it this feeling like every person he passes is by themselves. Like they're in their own little pocket world.
Yeah, Dave, it's called good directing. Yeah. What do you know? I can't complain. It just feels good to watch a show, you know, that we can just enjoy. They also did write by the Trill canon and expanded on what we know of Trill species.
Dude, that was amazing.
I was nervous about this part, Dave, because the Trill have a very special place in my heart.
Yes.
I mean,
I think you and every Star Trek fan.
It was one of my favorite elements in Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
And the way they use that psychedelic mindscape vibe works with what we've seen before in Deep Space Nine. And that ending, what they did with Gray and Adira does add up when you look at Trill canon.
Yes. Especially when they showed all the personalities and the whole the whole ritual concept that, you know, what is your name? Oh, my name is this of this and this and this and this. And then this is my name now. I mean, after this, I thought about in retrospect, this is the type of story I think Ira wanted to do in Deep Space Nine with Jadzia.
Oh, yeah. Without
the character of Jadzia, he wanted to do this type of story with her.
Well, he did it in the only way he could. There was an episode, I believe, titled Rejoined that I recently watched during my rewatches where Jadzia meets with a former love interest that's now in a different host.
A different host.
And the host happens to be a woman. And they did explore the queer experience and homophobia.
Yes.
In fact, if you look at the notes, I'm a Ronald D. Moore fan, a big Ronald D. Moore fan, and I believe he wrote that episode, so I pretty much know everything about the episodes he wrote, and I believe that was his entire point, to delve into homophobia.
Oh, yeah. And, like, that is something that was subliminally
I think subtle.
Subtle. Yeah. It was the subtle thing they did in Deep Space Nine, especially, you know, simply with like Sisko referring to Dax as old man constantly.
Oh, yeah.
Even though Dax is a woman right in front of him, he always refers to him as, hey, old man.
Right.
And then like, it's like,
I think Sisko is disrespectful because he wasn't, you know, acknowledging her new pronoun.
He wasn't.
I'm just going to say it, Dave.
Oh, Sisko would be so canceled.
Oh, I'm canceling him right now. I'm post-canceling Sisko.
Post-canceling Sisko.
Hashtag it.
But like that, even then, it was amazing what they were able to do with subtle context.
Yeah.
Here, they don't have to be subtle. And it's kind of freeing.
Well, because it's a different time and you can do things that you want to do. Now you also have to be careful because you don't want to be heavy handed with your identity politics or your politics when delving into the nuances of sexuality and identity. you do need to be careful. There is something to be said about the finer arts of being subtle, only because no one wants to watch something and feel like you're being preached to.
Yeah, but that honestly comes down to the writing itself.
Absolutely.
The actual mechanics of the writing is what can fix that.
Yeah. Yeah, it was good. So I am anxious to see what they do with that whole bit with Gray and Adira. As we know, based on Trill canon, former hosts or their consciousness do have the ability to project themselves. And we'll get into that a bit later towards the end of the show. We'll take a deep dive into a few Deep Space Nine episodes that I've recently rewatched. So they are fresh in my mind. One is Equilibrium and the other is Facets. And both of them strengthen the things that we saw in this episode. I did see some complaints about the Trill scenes between Gray and Adira. It's going to happen.
It's going to happen.
Some people were calling it liberals in space.
But it's like funny to me when you think about it. This is not new to Star Trek.
No, this isn't. This is nothing new in Trek. There's always been gay allegories or metaphors. Expressing these thoughts are simply not new.
I just
there's think that- nothing you can say to say this is a new thing. And I don't wish Dave to get controversial or invalidate anyone's opinions. I understand we are in a time where everything is a little more divisive and people I feel are just ready to get mad about the littlest of things.
Well, yeah.
If they feel like there's an agenda. And I feel like certain aspects of Star Trek Discovery definitely falls into that category. People are just like, oh, fuck it. Here we go again. They're going to tell me how to treat gay people. You know, so I understand. Because we are in a very odd time right now in history where people are just ready to get mad about everything.
Mm-hmm.
But we can't sit and pretend that these are new ideas.
Exactly. And they're not. And that's the thing is kind of like, that's why in the beginning of the show, I believe the beginning of the show or the pre-show, I basically said, if you are at this point hating on Discovery, you're just hating on it just because it's not your cup of tea.
I think you're just mad.
Yeah, you're just mad.
You can't watch Discovery and think it sucks.
Yeah,
it may not be your thing, but to say it sucks is just not. You're being untruthful. It's good.
Yes.
All right. Get more Star Trek from the Holodeck every month by subscribing to our Patreon page. There are two specific tiers that Holodeck listeners would absolutely love. It's the $3 tier, which is the behind-the-scenes tier where we give you bonus discussions, pre-shows. We do a pre-show pretty much before every full episode, and we get into the little odds and ends. We reiterate things. We kind of get the kinks out of our system. And we also have the $5 tier, which is our podcast tier, and it gives you everything from the $3 tier, but also additional two episodes a month. So if you wanted to help us stay on the air, please head over to patreon.com/RaymanDigital and pledge. Really the only way we can continue to do these shows. We are competing in a mass of podcasts, and we used to do a lot better until the big corporations got involved with podcasting. I would say, 3-4 years ago is when it really took the world by storm. And because they're dealing with big budgets, it's a little harder for us to cut through the noise, especially when you're trying to buy advertisement on Facebook and Google. We're competing with click traffic with these bigger companies that have bigger budgets. So Patreon is the best way to help us out. Patreon.com/RainManDigital. All right. I want to start with Burnham. She is so fantastic this season. They continue to highlight how different she really is.
Yeah.
This season. Much of that emotional baggage, as we mentioned last episode, has been replaced with a true sense of confidence. And we see that not just through her through lazy exposition, which is what a lot of TV shows would do, but by the way she interacts with the crew. You're letting the writing and the acting speak.
Speak, yeah.
The decisions she makes, she smiles. She comes across relatively content. But But this doesn't mean they deconstructed her characterization either. Want to make sure that's clear, because sometimes when you have such a stark change, I guess, in behavior, some people may scream foul ball. Well, this is a different character. This isn't even the same character. You just completely changed her because there were problems with it before. But I don't think that's the case.
No. I mean, they even make that point in her dialogue with the doctor in the very beginning when the doctor requests her to be the one to go down on the to the planet with
Adira. Yeah.
And the doctor acknowledging that, hey, Burnham's journey is not forgotten. She got to this point because of the journey that she took.
Dave, that is a perfect way of saying it. I couldn't agree with you more. That is the best way to say it, because she still feels like her.
Yeah.
Her bluntness, which is her, you know, obviously her Vulcan upbringing. It's still there. We saw that with how she acted at times with Adira. It was very matter of fact.
But like, and then also they haven't forgotten her emotional part, where Burnham is infamous throughout season one and season two to being very emotional. That's what brings that conflict with that Vulcan side. And that moment when the Trill themselves tell Burnham and Adira, hey, we can't help you. And Burnham looks so emotionally distraught that she's like going, wait a minute. And she lets her emotions guide her in that moment. That's who Burnham is.
Yeah. I think they're doing a really good job with her. And they really, really excited to see what they do with her moving forward, because there's so much more. I know they have dropped some breadcrumbs when it comes to how she's feeling. And I'm hoping we explore that more. I know we will. And I'm patient, because there's a lot going on and it doesn't feel like they have lost sight of her. It's the complete opposite. They have really zeroed in on her as a person. It feels like Michelle Paradise joining that writing room this year, it feels like she has found ways to zero in on certain characters and really make them work. Take the things that were really great about them and bring that to the surface a little bit more. And honestly, season three for Burnham, Dave, and tell me if you don't feel the same way, but season three for Burnham feels a lot like what they did with TNG season two with Captain Picard. They softened the character up a bit. With TNG, though, they just simply wrote him a bit differently. They're just like, okay, we're going to write him differently. We're going to have him interact a little less stern with certain people. Whereas with Burnham, they wrote her character changes within the actual narrative.
Within the narrative, yeah.
It's more seamless this way.
And it feels more organic, and I think that
do you agree with that, though?
I absolutely agree with it, because like when you take a look at like what we've been talking about in the past two episodes, our feelings towards Burnham as an audience have utterly changed, and I've seen it in the comments where people are now more excited to see Burnham because she is more positive. She is kind of like the face of the Federation. She's our last hope for the Federation.
And we understand how she was portrayed for the first two seasons. We understand that. It makes perfect sense. We just never had any time for her to rest and kind of collect herself between season one, season two. Everything was just kind of go, go, go. And we never had. There was no way you could actually build that into the writing, because they chose to go from season one directly into season two with the introduction of the Enterprise and then with the issues of Spock. There was never a moment for Burnham to reflect on any of her problems.
And then by throwing that magical "a year has passed,"
yeah,
that gave Burnham the time to basically reflect and reset herself.
Yep.
And honestly, dude, doing that, I was a little hesitant about it in our last episode. I was a little hesitant with that concept. Mm-hmm. But now that I've seen this episode that we're covering today and then the past episode, it does feel more organic. It's almost like we watched Burnham mature.
Yeah, David, it's called writing cheats. And guess what? When you know how to write, you can make those gimmicks work for you. And obviously, the writing room under the leadership of Michelle Paradise, they fucking can write. and they can make things work. And even the way they wrote this episode with the parallel narratives, using Burnham and Adira to push the main story forward, you know, because you want to keep that momentum with the myth arc, right? The main story.
Yeah.
Finding the Federation. But then that parallel narrative being, of course, Dr. Culbert and Saru, along with the crew, allowing things to slow down for them a bit on board the ship so that we can take some time to flesh out the nuances of our ship's crew. That's how you write an episode, without forgetting things, without letting things drop off the back of the wagon as you plow down the path. Dr. Hugh Culbert, Wilson Cruz, man, thank you for letting him do his thing. I am thankful that we were able to see him act on his own as an individual, letting this character be in his own character, you know, rather than always seeing him in that relationship setting, which I just got tired of.
Yeah. And we mentioned that in the last episode.
We actually, Dave, get to see him do what he was supposed to do. He's the fucking doctor of the ship. You know, not the gay arm candy.
Yeah.
I mean, he can be the gay arm candy because he's a good looking motherfucker. But also, let him be the goddamn doctor of the ship.
And dude.
And that's exactly what we got for this, or in this episode.
In this episode. And the thing I loved about this, you showed a side of the character that was so, it was so different, because seeing him be kind of like that empathic figure. Right.
A doctor.
He's a freaking doctor. And he's like so empathic. It made me remember like the bonuses of a character like Deanna Troi.
Yeah.
Deanna Troi, the strength of Troi was her empathy.
And she helped she did help us understand the psychology of the crew when we needed to.
Yes. And here Culbert does this. And I have to say, this was actually done to perfection.
Yeah.
I mean, when you compare the two characters, I honestly think of Culbert as kind of like that Troi character who is empathic.
Well, he has a great bedside manner. His demeanor is very
approachable.
Approachable. Yeah. Like I'm just glad they're using him like this, like they were supposed to. And the way they wrote this entire bit is the best way possible. They use his doctor's log and his concern for the crew as a way to push the plot forward. But more importantly, to explore the issues that's plaguing the crew.
Yes.
The crew is suffering with loss. They feel alone, disconnected. And it's a dark thought. If they were to just simply disappear, there'd be no one to miss them. That's a very strong narrative ingredient.
It is.
In fact, in the writing room, I can imagine them saying, all right, what are we going to give our crew this year? Let's try to put them under one umbrella, guys, because we have 50,000 crew members. So let's give them one theme that will govern their characterization for this season, for the most part. Well, they're off on their own. They have left everything behind, everything they know. And then when they get to the future, there's no Federation. The future looks a little bleak. Well, let's have them deal with depression.
You know, yeah.
Feeling alone,
dealing with depression and anxiety, dealing with mental health.
Yeah, which is all things that would make sense logically.
Logically.
Of course this would work, right? I mean, Detmer has some kind of PTSD.
Yep.
Having the entire responsibility of the crew.
And I appreciate
as a pilot.
I appreciate the fact that it was treated like Culbert doesn't just approach this throughout the entire story. He doesn't approach it kind of like, oh, I know this automatically just by looking at them. There's actually, when he talks to the captain and basically brings up like the recordings about stress, mm-hmm. and it gave it that realism, you know, the whole talk about, there's one thing that I've always noticed, especially nowadays with people who try to write mental health stories, fail. Because they don't understand it.
They don't fully understand
it. They don't fully understand it. Here, the way it's written, it actually makes it palatable. And basically, was done brilliantly through Culber, basically showing it through his bedside and him as a doctor.
Someone on the staff understands how psychology works.
Yeah.
And also how psychologists work for the most part, because when the doctor tells Detmer, you know, I'm going to paraphrase here, but when he basically tells her when she wants to talk, come find him, that's essentially what you do. You don't force someone to communicate. You wait until they're ready to communicate what their problems are. So the episode was grounded a bit in reality. No, not a bit. Very much in reality. When it comes to the psychology of the crew. And I really like that, especially with the Detmer angle and using her a bit as the anchor of the crew. They really used her as the element that would kick everyone off in that room where they were eating dinner. Like, she was the one that was suffering overtly with the problem. And by using her as that anchor, they were able to then just knock all the cards down and really get into the meat of the crew's issues.
Especially when the two characters that I appreciated the most, that had the most animosity towards each other, was her versus Stamets.
Can I get into that fight as well? Can I be? I'm team Detmer, because Stamets needs to lose that frown all the time. I mean, that dude just walks around morose constantly. He's always upset.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
He's moody. Someone needs to smack him.
And this is that.
Hey, Culver.
This was the moment.
Keep your man in check, bro.
This was the moment with Stamets that I went going, we should have had a couple episodes ago where someone just basically forces Stamets to basically acknowledge that the way he's been acting.
Be a human.
Be a fucking human, dude.
Yeah.
You have to rely on other people and apologize and basically understand the way you treat people is why you feel the way you do. Yeah. And his acknowledgement of it.
I love it. I love it because it's not overly melodramatic.
It's not overly melodramatic.
They're dealing with things that would actually happen. And it wasn't, you know, dragged out either. You know, they dealt with it pretty much in this episode.
Oh, yeah.
Obviously, the ramifications of this trauma is going to last throughout the season. But them accepting it and saying, yes, this is our problem, it wasn't dragged out. If Detmer went around for another five episodes and we didn't know what her problem was and she was just scowling all the time and people were fighting with each other, we would feel like something's missing. But they brought it to the forefront. They knocked it out the park, and now we can kind of move forward.
That's the key phrase there, because at the end of this, you don't have a sense that, oh, all the problems are fixed. No.
No, far from it.
The main thing was moving forward. They acknowledged their problems, and now they're going to move forward as a crew. And that's what I really appreciated toward the end, when you watch them in watching the silent film. And, you know, Detmer and Stamets apologize to each other. And you have Saru talking with Culber in the very end. And Saru makes the comment that this is just the first step.
Right.
Yeah. It's the beginning. We're not fully fixed, but we took the right steps forward.
Yeah.
Dude, that was an intelligent, and I'm glad they did that, because then, just like what you mentioned earlier, then you enter heavy-handed territory.
Right.
Where if you make it just say, everyone's happy, the whole thing is fixed.
Oh, yay!
That's when it becomes heavy-handed.
Yeah, and these are things that we have explored before, and I believe not nearly as... No, actually, we did. Voyager delved into this quite a bit with the psychological aspects of being far from home.
Yes.
And leaving everything behind. In fact, I want to say the first 2 years were really governed by that idea of learning to be alone.
Yeah.
Learning to rely on each other less like a crew and more like a family. And it made the dynamics of that show very different than any other show we've ever were given at that time in terms of Star Trek. And now Discovery is in that same territory. We can start exploring a very different dynamic between the crew, because essentially they are all who they know. And even when they get to the Federation and they meet other people, they're always going to feel a little out of their element. I mean, they skip past over a thousand years of history, over 1,000 years of technology and learning. So they're always going to feel slightly out of place. And I believe what we're seeing is the beginnings of a very interesting dynamic amongst the crew.
Oh, yeah. Because the difference between this and what Voyager went through was they emphasized here that the crew of the Discovery constantly suffered from this trauma without having that breather. They, you know, in season one, they shot right out of the gates, mirror universe, Klingons, fight, war everywhere, right? And then in season two, Emmer loses her eye. And then in season two, you jump from a wartime scenario to the mystery of the Red Angel. And guess what? Control's going to destroy the entire universe. Then you have to deal with that trauma and that high octane stressful environment. And then Discovery season three, you're seeing the aftermath. Suddenly they make this great sacrifice and say, we're going to take the ship, go into the future where we could keep this knowledge out of Control's hands at a great cost. They give up on their families.
But, and there's no chance. Like with Voyager, there was always hope of getting home. Whereas with the Discovery crew, there's no hope of seeing. They're gone. They're dead. Gone. Everyone, everything they've ever known is gone.
They have to make a true sacrifice.
And that's why I'm glad at the end of the day that this was actually important for the writers in that room to actually flesh out.
Yeah,
that they actually thought about the details and they said, well, we got to do this. And the best way to do that is with these characters. We have said since day one that our biggest problem with Discovery is that we didn't have a lot of emphasis put on the crew, that many times we just didn't understand who these people were. They would pop in and then I don't even think we knew their names until the beginning of season two. So now we have the perfect situation to really get to know the crew. And I'm another element that I'm just really happy about this season.
Yeah. Do you realize in three episodes, we have gotten closer to this crew than in the past two seasons?
Yeah.
That one scene that just set the tone for me had to be the one where Saru's talking. I think it's either to the computer or he's talking to Tilly, where he says, you know, watching Pike lead this crew was far different than what I thought I could do. Mm-hmm. And it was like, it took everything that Saru has been in the last two seasons, going through, you know, the whole transformation of himself physically and mentally. And suddenly he's captain. He's the captain in the ship. He's a brand new captain. And even with all the changes he went through, he has to now deal with the aftermath. And that's what it's all about. It ties all the characters with having to deal with the trauma in the aftermath.
Right. Yeah. Okay, so Dave, let's move into the sphere information.
Oh, dude.
Did I say spear?
Yeah.
Let's say sphere.
The sphere. That was a surprise.
Okay. So the sphere's life forms, the sphere life forms, what they call it. The sphere life forms data assisted in helping Saru bring comfort to the crew, which opened up some really big doors for what we could see in the future for Discovery. The ship's computer being merged with the sphere data seems to have altered the ship's computer or even awakened it, possibly giving it some type of sentience, right? Meaning we could be witnessing the birth of a new intelligence. It would be artificial, but something very different because essentially its brain would be that of the sphere life form.
Life form, yeah.
As we saw in this episode, it's adapting to the confines of the ship's computer and communicating with Saru to assist him in resolving the issues on board. So, number one, I love that aspect, how Saru was able to, you know, through the powers of deductive skills, he realized that the ship is becoming something different.
Something different.
And is wanting to help them through their problems.
And now, I appreciate that, dude, because you do realize that given a different scenario and in a different writer's hands, let's say a less than capable writer,
mm-hmm.
you would automatically make Saru suspectful of the ship.
Right. It would be a whole thing.
Yeah. Instead, Saru, because he's gone through so much already at this point, is like, okay, I know that this has changed, but let's see where this goes.
And listen, I'm ready for something different with the computer.
Yeah.
We've had the same computer type deal for how many Star Trek shows? So why not get something with a little bit of personality, a little intelligence? Well, this very well could be the AI interface we saw in the Short Trek episode, Calypso.
Yes.
Where Discovery's computer took the name of Zora and was sentient.
Yeah. And that's what I think that the storyline here leads to. I honestly think that we're going to see the birth of the Zora personality.
Which would be really cool because, Dave, I believe you and I both agree that Calypso was and is still the best Short Treks episode.
One of the best. Because remember, we've gone back and forth about Calypso, one of the other Short Treks in the recent run.
But it was the Short Treks episode that left a big question mark.
Yes.
Because the way the episode was written, it explained that Zora was the name taken by the computer of the USS Discovery after the ship had been abandoned for almost 1,000 years. The computer had, over the centuries, developed an artificial intelligence complete with a personality. So now, in retrospect, we're like, well, this makes perfect sense, especially with the sphere data. And we know that the sphere data is what? Hundreds of thousands of years old, this giant, all-knowing life form. That's the reason why they had to go to the future in the first place.
Yeah, and remember,
to make sure that data, that information, didn't fall into the hands of control.
They still have to actually keep it out of control's hands.
Well, that raises some questions for sure, and it also may be the answer to that Short Treks episode, why Discovery was left abandoned for 1,000 years. Well, if you remember, the whole reason why they went to the future was because they needed to stay ahead of control. They needed to stay, I believe the term was perpetual infinity. They needed to always be ahead of control. So even right this moment, there's going to be a time where they're going to have to go into the future again, I would think, based on their logic. Unless, of course, they're in a time that control can't find them. And that was the point as well. I believe they had said that. That's why Pike and Spock all had to make up stories about what happened to Discovery, because yeah. they didn't want any information potentially leaking to control and then control finding exactly where Discovery went. So that being said, knowing that Discovery will always have to be hidden in some way from control, that would make sense that at some point Discovery will have to abandon, or the crew will have to abandon Discovery and make sure it's hidden. Otherwise, Control will find it. We're dealing with time travel. So Control, it doesn't matter when they find it. Control can find it in 5,000 years. And exactly. Guess what? It can still go right back to the time that Discovery Season 2 took place and do exactly what it wanted to do again.
Yep.
So this might be Calypso, in all actuality, might end up being the fate of Discovery. It might be one of the stepping stones to the final season. When we finally end the show, we might end up seeing them have to abandon Discovery.
And honestly, dude, I think that might be one of the most saddest moments in the future of Discovery. Because if you think about it, if throughout the season, if they build on the concept of this character, the ship, and it's starting to get personality, and then it takes the name of Zora, and Zora has to leave the crew, or the crew has to leave Zora. That's sad. That's going to be a sad moment.
Well, that's a sad story for the sphere data to begin with, because it was this being that has been alone for how many years? It was lonely, and now its destiny is to be alone again.
Alone again.
Yeah, and not die, because now it's a machine. Pretty rough.
It's rough.
That's Shakespearean as hell. But my hat's off. All right, let's go to a very quick break, and then when we get back, we're going to jump into some Trill Talk.
double dumbass on you.
Fire everything!
Free stuff is awesome, but free stuff that will spice up your bedroom is even better. Just go to adamandeve.com and select almost any one item for 50% off, and then we'll load on the free stuff. Just enter this very exclusive code, RAINMAN, at checkout, and you'll get 10 tantalizing free gifts, including a sexy item for him, a special toy for her,
ooh,
and a third item you'll both enjoy.
Ooh.
And 6 extra special bonus items that are sure to rev your engine, pique your curiosity, and even blow you away. Plus,
free shipping!
Always sent in discreet packaging. Go to adamandeve.com now. Get 50% off plus the 10 free gifts when you enter the exclusive offer code RAINMAN. Again, that's RAINMAN. Because without it,
no free stuff.
That's RAINMAN at adamandeve.com.
All right, welcome back, everyone, to Star Trek From the Holodeck on Rain Man Digital. All right, Dave, so let's talk about Adira and the Trill. I was paying special attention to these particular scenes because DS9 is probably my favorite Trek.
I figured you would.
And the Trill were such a great addition to the Trek mythos. They handled it very poorly in Next Generation. Let's be honest. The host episode, which I recently got to,
yeah,
during my rewatch,
it's not one of the best ones. Because it's, I think that I honestly think, dude,
it doesn't even make sense to what they ended up doing with the Trill. Never exactly. Mind the aesthetic look, how they changed the look of the Trill, the way they acted and treated it was almost as if the host didn't even exist. The host had no presence. It was just the symbiont. And that's completely not true when we look at what they did with it in Deep Space Nine. They also looked at it as a parasite.
A parasite, yeah.
And not an actual symbiont. So they definitely did wonders for the Trill aspect in Deep Space Nine. It was fantastic. It's one of 1,000 things they brought to the table in terms of Trek on that show, Deep Space Nine. That being said, I was very satisfied with how they handled the entire thing.
Oh, absolutely.
First off, the initial confrontation with the Trill was an allegory for acceptance and turning away from preconceived prejudices. This is consistent when pertaining to the host symbiont aspects of Trill culture. Number one.
Yeah.
Numerous times in Deep Space Nine, we witnessed their prejudice and lies. The concept of suitable host when it comes to Trill, we find out in later episodes of Deep Space Nine, I believe Equilibrium was a complete fabrication. It was a lie. They yes. lied about how difficult it was to find suitable hosts in order to protect symbiotes from becoming commodities. They thought this would protect their culture, but in the end, it felt more like a bunch of elitists making decisions yes. for the rest of their society.
Mm-hmm.
So, questions. We learn that the current Trill society in Discovery is on the brink of collapse and are unable to find viable hosts.
Yep.
So they must have really been killed off because of the burn.
Well,
because
cut off.
In Deep Space Nine, we find out that they're not, that it's not that hard of a process. That before, in Deep Space Nine, before it came out that they were lying, that it's actually not as difficult to find a suitable host.
Yeah. But if you think about it, being cut off, the concept of the burn, what it did to the Star Trek universe was it cut all races off from each other.
Right. But the Trill are the Trill. If they're on yeah. the home planet, why would they lose suitable hosts? Unless something happened on their planet that also killed them off.
Exactly.
Maybe they're on the brink of collapse because of being cut off. As we know, what would happen to the United States? What would happen to China? What would happen to Russia if we decided to become an isolist or isolationist, or we just lost other countries? We rely a lot on trade.
Mm-hmm.
So that could be the issue with the burn and the real society, that they are on the brink of collapse because they don't have any help.
Yeah.
They're all alone.
Their numbers started dwindling after a while because you got to remember this. The symbiote outlives the host by almost like 10 generations. So for every symbiote that actually shows up, well, that means that basically they need to find multiple hosts for that symbiote. So like, say for example, like with Adrena's with
Adrena, who's Adrena?
Or not Adrena. With
I want to help you, Dave, but I'm going to make you figure this one out.
With Gray's original trill. I can't remember what the
Adira.
With Adira's trill, it went through, from what we saw, at least 10 hosts.
Right.
So if you think about it, if there's so many symbiotes and it has to go through so many hosts,
mm-hmm.
their numbers are going to dwindle over time. They're the symbiotes.
People are born, Dave. People like the trill. There's two species of trill.
But then you throw in the burn, which they said that millions upon millions of people died.
I'm not complaining, Dave. Not complaining. I'm just saying that eventually the burn, you know, because let's be honest, the burn right now is a MacGuffin.
It is.
And as a MacGuffin right now, it works just fine. Yes. But eventually you're going to have to start explaining things because they are finding some writing cheats. Like, well, how are we going to explain that the trill are on the brink of annihilation and that there are no more suitable hosts? Let's just burn. And it works. Look, I always say this. If you know the rules of writing, you can fuck with them.
Just don't break them.
Right. And that's what they're doing. So the burn is essentially a MacGuffin, and they continue to use it since the season started as a way to kind of get past certain things. They don't want to get weighed down in the weeds, and that works. So I'm okay with that, but eventually it would be nice to get a little more explanation as to how the Trill Society is on the brink of collapse. That's just my own. Because we are heard in Deep Space Nine, and it's not nearly as difficult to find a suitable host.
True.
We'll see. So the way Adira broke through her memory blocks was also on par with what we've seen on Trek before. We know that the caves of Makala, how you say it?
Yes.
Have a way of connecting Trill to thoughts and memories. It's almost like a collective mind when they are submerged within that milky water, I guess. All Trill symbiotes work together to heal the wounded. So I like that. The psychedelic imagery that they use to make the ancestral plane more tangible was cool. And although we've never seen that before, we have seen this process before with Jadzia Dax.
Yep.
Her being dipped within the waters and communicating, but we just weren't privy to what they might be seeing. So that was cool. They didn't change anything.
No, they didn't.
They just said, hey, we've seen you dip in the water and regain your memories and talk to former hosts, but we've never seen what possibly they might see.
Yes.
That was cool. I thought that was fun. Towards the end of the episode, it was revealed that Adira can communicate with her dead boyfriend and former Tal symbiote. Obviously, this was all within her head, her mind. It wasn't there. I know some people were confused. No, she's not alive. She's dead, or he's dead. Some might think it was a little odd, but it actually does work with canon. In the Deep Space Nine episode Facet, Jadzia Dax performs a Trill ritual, which allows her to meet previous Dax hosts. It does require a guardian, one of the guardians, and the process is performed telepathically.
Yep.
So the consciousness or memories can be manifested or put into a vessel of sorts and communicate as an individual, which is what we saw in that episode of Deep Space Nine. So whatever is happening with Adira and Gray can easily be explained and is consistent with Star Trek canon.
With Star Trek canon, yeah. And as I said prior, dude, it amazes me with this episode because you could easily see a storyline like this or an episode like this being written for Jadzia, and it would be amazing. Especially if you were to take the characters of Jadzia and Ezri Dax. This is probably what Ira was heading for if he wanted to. Or if he not if he wanted
allowed to.
If he was allowed to.
The studios allowed him to, Dave. Yes.
Yeah. If the studio allowed him to, this is the type of episode we would have gotten Deep Space Nine.
For sure. I would definitely agree with that. So much Trill canon. I don't think we're done with the Trill. I hope not. But I did like the way it ended, where the leader said, hopefully you keep us up to date on Adira's progress. And when you find the Federation, please come back. I loved it because it stays true to what the purpose of this season is about, which is about the restructuring, the rejuvenation of the Federation, that they will bring hope. So I did like that, especially since I don't think the Trill have ever been officially a part of the Federation. So if the Trill species is like the first new addition or new member to the Federation, I think that's a good win for this show, that they bring in a species that's never been a part of the Federation.
Is it me, or is it the one thing I wrote down here is like, mm-hmm. one of the biggest messages or themes mm-hmm. I think we're going to see in season 3 of Discovery is the concept of connections, because they're going to want to, if you notice the past couple of episodes, it really comes down to reconnecting with another species, whether it be or reconnecting with another planet, like what happened in the last episode when they went back to Earth.
Yeah.
And basically, even dealing with the crew, you see the theme of connection and all of them trying to find, to communicate and connect with each other so that they can become stronger. That they can achieve what the Federation was.
Well, yeah, they're not losing sight of who they are and what they're about. And you always got to have that. And maybe that's some of the problems I had with Picard, you know, because Picard never really quite felt like Star Trek to me. And I am well aware, and I'm actually a champion, that Star Trek can be many things.
Yeah.
But there comes a point when you veer so far away, you kind of shrug and say, why though then? Why even do this if it's not going to be anything remotely similar to Star Trek? I mean, look at Deep Space Nine, which when that premiered in 1993, I believe, was one of the biggest shocking moments at that time for Star Trek. Wait a second. You're going to have a show that's on a space station? But Star Trek's all about seeking out new life and new civilizations, exploring. So it was a big change for a lot of people. But when it came down to it, the show at its core was governed by all the similar themes that Star Trek is governed by.
Yeah.
And Picard, I feel like, yes, had some of those themes, but it just veered so far away from anything we've ever seen before that it was hard to really connect with the show as a Star Trek series. Whereas Discovery continues on that mission and reminds us numerous times that this is Starfleet. This is the Federation. This is what we are about.
And it's like, just like what you said, once you start veering away from the concept and trying to change the concept that you're working with, at one point, if you go way out there, the concept you're working on ceases being the original concept. So, like, the problem that I see with Picard is, like, it tried to be so different of a Star Trek series. It wanted to be it didn't want to focus on the core tenets of the Federation. In fact, it wanted to show that the Federation in a different light.
Mm-hmm.
That it lost its own self,
yeah,
self image.
I think we can leave it at that, Dave. You're right. It lost itself, and it wasn't really quite sure how to identify and how to
actually establish. Okay, fine. If you're going to do that, establish yourself then.
Yeah. And Discovery is not having those problems. Never had those problems, honestly. And this season just is everything that was great about previous seasons multiplied by 100. Yeah. Fantastic. All right. So the spore drive is becoming more important. as we said.
More so than ever now.
Didn't we say that? I want to say in episode one that the spore drive is going to be the thing now, because
yeah, we contemplated that basically, like, maybe this is how they get around now, is because of the spore drive.
We always knew that something was going to happen to the spore drive, because when they introduced the concept in season one, we knew that this couldn't be a thing. For whatever reason, spore drives don't exist in Star Trek canon. And if they're as great as they were making it out to be in season one, then we would have seen other ships use the spore drive.
Yeah.
Something's going to happen to that spore drive. We had thought that it would somehow go to the Mirror Universe, which originally that's where the entire show was going to take place for the first season, was the Mirror Universe, when Brian Fuller was the showrunner. And then with the time travel aspect, now it works to remove the spore drive, something we've never seen in Star Trek canon. Remove it and now put it in a timeline where they can use it. And it can now be the future of starships. It feels like that's what they're doing, especially after what Saru told Stamets, that this is something we're going to need.
Yeah.
So they're going to start working on a more practical plan. And I thought that was a nice little addition to the episode as well.
I thought that was a really smart addition, too, because, like,
well, it makes sense. What if something does happen to Stamets? What if
something happens to Stamets? And I like the fact that not only did it address the issue of, like, how does the ship go around, but again, they use that concept to not just focus on one central thing, but also bring in the character's issue or story arc tied to it. Bringing in the fact that Stamets can't honestly rely on anyone because he's too egotistical to actually do it. And the main reason why that they haven't found a separate way of using the spore drive is because Stamets doesn't want anyone to do it besides him. And I'm like going, that was actually a really smart way of approaching the episode and how everything just seemed to flow together and connect to each other. Now it makes me wonder, though. All right. They have to address the fact that in season two, using the spore drive damages the mycelial network. Because remember, that was the whole reason why they had the issue originally with Discovery, where they found out that doing all these spore jumps actually damaged the mycelial network, and thus the mycelial network decided to fight back.
Yeah. So right.
They have to actually bring back something from season two.
Yeah. Everything works. Everything feels seamless. They're bringing things that might have been lost for a while or we lost sight of. They're bringing it back in. Our crew, the spore drive. A lot of good things happening this season. It's still very early.
Still early.
We're only three episodes in, and I believe there are 13 episodes this season. So we still have a ways to go. But so far, so good. The groundwork is there. The foundation is sturdy. And I'm going to give this episode a 95%.
I'm going to be with you right there. I'm going to give this episode a 98, actually, because after watching this, I actually thought to myself, I enjoyed this episode so much. I think this is arguably my favorite Discovery episode. I mean, yes.
It's definitely one of the best.
It's
for sure.
It's definitely one of the best. And I'm like thinking to myself, well, I really like those episodes with Pike. The ones with Pike are just so awesome. However, I can't deny the fact that when you look at how this episode was built and written with its multiple layers and dimensions going on, like, as I alluded to in the very beginning, it deals with concepts not just about connections and communications, but then you get to the whole story of Gray and dealing with grief and loss and how that running away from your grief, all of a sudden that's why her memories were all messed up, because she wanted to forget that great trauma.
Right.
And it made sense. Because you touch on a real subject of losing someone you love like that. And yeah, that is dealing with trauma, and that's dealing with grief.
Yeah, it's good, Dave. And I know there are people complaining. They feel like it's over liberal. There's like moments of soapboxing. But I would have to disagree.
I agree. I don't see the soapbox
here. I don't care, because as long as the writing's good, it's always going to work for me. I don't care if Saru starts fucking Stamets.
Just randomly.
If the writing's good, I don't give a shit what you do. All right. It's time to end this show. I want to thank everybody for listening. Thank you, David.
Thank you. Live long and prosper.
I couldn't help but notice your pain.
My pain?
It runs deep. Share it with me.
End simulation.